Welcome to Nightlights. This is David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, we'll be listening to the first of a two-part program exploring the life and music of an influential saxophonist and composer who walked away from the jazz world in mid-career. It's Gigi Grice Part 1, Social Call, coming up on this edition of Nightlights. trumpeter Donald Byrd and alto saxophonist Gigi Grice doing Grice's Social Call off the album Modern Jazz Perspective. Grice and Byrd backed by Wynton Kelly on piano, Wendell Marshall on bass, and Art Taylor on drums, that recording done for Columbia in 1957. Alto saxophonist and composer Gigi Grice is one of the great mysteries of modern jazz. Jazz fans may know his frequently covered tunes such as Minority, Nika's Tempo, or Social Call, but they know little about the man who wrote them. In the 1950s, he seemed on the verge of becoming a musical legend, only to leave the jazz world behind and disappear for the last 20 years of his life. What happened to this sensitive, prolific composer and player? During this edition of Nightlights, the first of a two-part program, we'll be listening to the music of Gigi Grice and the reflections of Michael Fitzgerald, co-author of the award-winning Gigi Grice biography, Rat Race Blues. Gigi Grice played with Thelonious Monk and Quincy Jones, Clifford Brown and Art Blakey, and then he simply vanished from the jazz world in the early 1960s. Michael Fitzgerald and Noel Cohen, in their book, described Grice as something of a paradox, even to his closest associates and family, and more so to those attempting to study him from a historical perspective. Michael Fitzgerald elaborates.
Well, he was definitely an unusual sort of personality for a jazz musician at that time. When we think about stereotypes and the typical examples of musicians that were drinking and smoking and using drugs and chasing women, all these things, Gigi didn't have anything to do with that. He was, from the early 50s, he was a devout Muslim. And he did not drink at all. He never used drugs. He was very education-minded. He had studied at Boston Conservatory with the great composer Alan Hovhaness. He really valued sort of the traditional education so that when he came onto the jazz scene with musicians who were perhaps more street musicians, people like Jackie McLean or someone like that, he was really sort of the complete opposite, and yet he was able to work with the exact same people. So Gigi Grice was able to play with Art Blakey, and Jackie McLean was able to play with Art Blakey, and they really each contributed something of their own personality to the music, and there were a few others that were like Gigi in his sort of circle, people like Benny Golson, people like Clifford Brown, that really sort of stood apart from what was sort of expected of jazz musicians at that time.
Gigi Grice was born in Pensacola, Florida, November 28, 1925. He grew up in a family that valued education, and he took to music early. At the age of 10, he enrolled as a pupil in a WPA instruction program, learning to play the clarinet. By all accounts, a quiet, intelligent, and studious child, he witnessed a terrible event, the murder of his teacher, Grice biographer Michael Fitzgerald.
Joseph Jesse was the first music instructor in that Federal Music Project in Pensacola, Florida, and he was directing a band rehearsal outdoors at one of the local schools, and some of the younger students would come by and sort of watch the rehearsals, and Gigi was one of those. There was a sort of a hoodlum or a delinquent that was stirring up some trouble with members of the band by throwing pebbles into the bell of the baritone horn of one of the players. And so Joseph Jesse, the director, sort of stopped the rehearsal and went over to try and find this delinquent's parents and talk to them. And the young man went and got a shotgun and shot him dead. It was a tragic thing to occur for Gigi to witness at such an early age.
Despite this early violent incident, Grice continued his musical studies. His family's emphasis on education, combined with the support of various governmental programs, enabled him to begin the artistic journey that would take him to the flourishing 1950s jazz scene of New York. He thrived in the little-known but historically significant 1940s Naval Great Lakes bands, where other musicians such as Clark Terry, Gerald Wilson, Lou Donaldson, and John Coltrane all spent time. After the war, he used the GI Bill to attend the Boston Conservatory of Music, his stay coinciding with an an era when future luminaries like Jackie Byard, Sam Rivers, and Joe Gordon were all present and playing in the Boston scene. Following his studies at the conservatory, Grice moved to Manhattan in 1952. There he would join a musical world that included Thelonious Monk, Art Blakey, and a host of other jazz greats. He recorded one of his own compositions, Shabazz, with trumpeter Howard McGhee. Grice biographer Michael Fitzgerald.
Shabazz is, again, it's a very early composition, 1953, one of Gigi's first recording sessions after he came to New York City. He had been in Boston, sort of away from some of these people. He would meet with some of the visiting musicians, and Howard McGhee was someone who did come through the Boston area, and they would play at jam sessions. And when Gigi came to New York City, he hooked up with these people almost immediately, Max Roach and then Howard McGhee. Shabazz is a very difficult tune in terms of the chord progression, and on that recording, the musicians make it sound easy. It's a wonderful thing. It's a rare opportunity to hear the guitarist Hal Farlow in connection with those musicians.
Thank you.
Trumpeter Howard McGee doing Gigi Grice's Shabazz in 1953, backed by Grice on alto sax and flute, Tal Farlow on guitar, Horace Silver on piano, Percy Heath on bass, and Walter Bolden on drums, from the CD Howard McGee Volume 2 on Blue Note. Around this time, Gigi Grice made a religious change in his life. Although a number of African-American jazz musicians, such as Art Blakey, had begun converting to Islam in the late 1940s, Michael Fitzgerald says the reasons for Grice's conversion are still somewhat unclear.
We're not exactly sure of what happened. In some writings, he spoke of meeting a gentleman, sort of, I'm not sure whether a priest or something like that, someone affiliated with the Islamic faith, and this would be about 1951 or 52, towards the end of his college years, and just sort of being inspired by that. But I think it was definitely something that was in the air at that time, the idea that the black Americans needed to find something that would really value them, because they felt disenfranchised from the religions that were more based for the white people.
In 1953, Grice joined the band of Tad Dameron, a pianist, composer, and arranger who would have a strong influence on the young alto saxophonist. Grice also formed a musical alliance with a colleague in the Dameron band, the rising trumpet star Clifford Brown, Michael Fitzgerald on their recording of an early Grice classic.
"Hymn to the Orient" is a very early tune of Gigi Grice's. That was the first recording of that was done by Stan Getz in the very early 1950s. And it's a piece in C minor that is just a burner. And Clifford Brown's solo on that piece has been singled out as one of the greatest trumpet solos ever. And that was just really the session that really opened a lot of people's ears to what Clifford Brown could do. That 1953 Blue Note session. Thank you.
Trumpeter Clifford Brown in 1953 doing Gigi Grice's Hymn to the Orient, backed by Grice on alto sax, Charlie Rouse on tenor sax, John Lewis on piano, Percy Heath on bass, and Art Blakey on drums from the Clifford Brown Memorial Album on Blue Note. Clifford Brown also took part in the next stage of Gigi Grice's career, joining the Lionel Hampton Band just before it traveled to France in the autumn of 1953, Michael Fitzgerald.
Well, the Lionel Hampton Band was a very curious thing because there was a dichotomy in that band of younger musicians, including Gigi and Quincy Jones, and the older musicians that had played with Lionel Hampton for many years, people like Al Hayes, the trombonist, or Curly Hamner, one of the drummers, Billy Mackell, the guitar player. And Lionel Hampton was trying to sort of worked both sides of the street. He wanted to have his traditional swing material, but he also wanted to have these young musicians who were playing bebop. And so he tried to do this by sort of having half and half in his band. Quincy Jones was another musician who had studied in Boston at the Schillinger House, which is now Berklee College of Music. And so Gigi and Quincy had met up in Boston prior to that, and then both had come down to the New York area and worked. Quincy was actually with Lionel Hampton a little bit earlier than Gigi, and they met up in around the Jersey Shore in 1953, and Lionel Hampton was looking for some players, and he hired Gigi, and he hired Clifford Brown, the trumpeter, and Art Farmer, another trumpeter. And so they all got together, and they fit together very well.
Hampton strictly forbade his musicians from recording away from the band, but Brown, Grice, and others managed to steal away at odd hours, eager to commit their own music to permanence. Michael Fitzgerald on Brownskins, a Grice composition recorded on the sly by Hampton band members in France.
That's another fantastic example of Gigi's orchestrational abilities. It begins with a slow section that's really orchestral, really has sort of a classical sound to it, and then moves into a very up-tempo version on Cherokee chord changes featuring Clifford Brown. That was a tune that was actually performed by the Lionel Hampton band at their concerts, and at the time it wasn't known as Brownskins. Lionel Hampton would introduce that as the Grice Suite. So that was something that audiences actually did get a chance to hear the Lionel Hampton band perform live.
Thank you.
Gigi Grice leading an orchestra of French musicians and members of the Lionel Hampton Band, doing Grice's composition Brown Skins in 1953 off the CD Clifford Brown in Paris, Complete Sessions Volume 1. This is David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Gigi Grice Part 1, Social Call on Nightlights. We're playing the music of alto saxophonist and composer Gigi Grice on this edition of Nightlights, the first of a two-part program, including comments from Michael Fitzgerald, who co-wrote the award-winning Grice biography Rat Race Blues with Noel Cohen. Not long after returning from the Lionel Hampton European tour to the United States, Gigi Grice joined Art Blakey for an LP of nearly all Grice compositions. One of these was Salute to the Bandbox, also known as Salute to Birdland.
A remarkable thing that at such an early stage of the game that you would have an album just it's all but one of the tunes on it are Gigi's compositions. Salute to the Bandbox is an example of what's called a contrafact, which is a melody that's written to existing chord changes. So there are many pieces that are written on I Got Rhythm, and this is written on the chord changes of I'll Remember April, and there's a section early on in the melody that, as far as we've been able to determine, this is the first time it happened, and then it was picked up by Miles Davis and used in his recording of I'll Remember April, the part that says bo ba ba da 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 bo ba ba da 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 bo ba ba da 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 bo ba ba da ba da, and that's a particular favorite phrase that Gigi used in his solos. We sort of talk about that during in the book, sort of through the years. That was a little pet phrase of his, and he put together this great new melody to existing chords, and then the performance by the Blakey Band, including the trumpeter Joe Gordon, who was another colleague of Gigi's in Boston, is just a wonderful thing.
drummer Art Blakey performing Gigi Grice's Salute to the Bandbox, also known as Salute to Birdland, backed by Grice on alto sax, Joe Gordon on trumpet, Bernard Griggs on bass, and Walter Bishop on piano from the 1954 LP Blakey. In 1953, Gigi Grice married Eleanor Sears, with whom he would begin to raise a family several years later. He would also continue to form important musical partnerships in the mid-1950s. One of these was with trumpeter Art Farmer.
After they came back from Europe in December of 1953, Art Farmer and Gigi Grice worked together in a quintet with various players in the rhythm section. They recorded several albums for the Prestige label, and it was a working band. They did play gigs. It wasn't just in the studio. And it's my feeling that the combination of Gigi Grice and Art Farmer is really the ideal match in terms of compatibility, because they both really were strong lyrical players. They really had the same conception in terms of improvisation. So when you hear the alto solo end and the trumpet solo begin, it's really like it's one person playing two instruments, which is sort of different from some of the other bands that Gigi was involved in later, something like his band with Richard Williams. It was a great trumpet player, but it was more an idea of contrast in that band, where Richard Williams was more of an extravagant player. Art Farmer was really understated, very lyrical, and they worked very well together. Thank you.
Trumpeter Art Farmer doing Gigi Grice's The Infant Song, backed by Grice on alto sax, Freddie Redd on piano, Addison Farmer on bass, and Art Taylor on drums from the 1955 album When Farmer Met Grice. By this time, Gigi Grice had begun to establish himself as a teacher and a mentor on the 1950s New York jazz scene. Michael Fitzgerald.
During his entire career, Gigi was a teacher. You know, prior to leaving the jazz world and becoming a full-time teacher, he was teaching all the time. When he was in Hartford, Connecticut, at the end of the 40s, he was teaching there informally. When he was in Boston, he was teaching. People like the saxophonist Makonda Ken McIntyre studied with him. While Gigi himself was a student at Boston Conservatory, he was sharing his knowledge with other musicians. When he got to New York, musicians sort of came to him a lot of, mostly because of the publishing knowledge that he had. And he was always being something of a crusader in teaching musicians about copyrights, in teaching them about how to hold on to their compositions. So he was sort of a resource to them. It wasn't something, again, that was overbearing. He would just sort of stress the idea that your music is important and it's something that you should hold on to. So people came to him and learned about that. People like Donald Byrd, people like Horace Silver, who are today some of the strongest proponents of composers owning their own music. Well, they learned it from Gigi Grice.
In 1955, Grice made an ensemble recording that demonstrated his developing musical sensibilities. Michael Fitzgerald on one of the tracks from that session.
In a Meditating Mood really shows off Gigi's orchestration abilities. You hear this the trombone, the French horns, the mixture of all these instruments together just to create an incredible sound that's really, it's somewhat based on the Miles Davis Birth of the Cool Band, the Nonet. But Gigi really brings a different kind of a flavor to it, a more lyrical sense. And in fact, that's a piece that does have lyrics that have never been recorded, Gigi and John Hendricks wrote. And it's just, you can, you know, if you know the lyrics. Unfortunately, I don't think anyone other than a few people do, but the melody statement, it just fits right on that. It's just a beautiful, beautiful lyrical piece.
Thank you. G.G. Grice leading a large ensemble in a performance of his composition In a Meditating Mood, featuring trombonist Jimmy Cleveland from the Savoy LP Nika's Tempo. During these sessions, Grice also recorded with the enigmatic Thelonious Monk, leading 2 years later to the famous Monk's Music Date. When the Great Day in Harlem photo of dozens of jazz musicians was taken in 1958, Grice was the only one with whom Monk spoke on his way to the shoot. Michael Fitzgerald and Grice's relationship with Monk, musical and otherwise.
I think that Monk had a lot of respect for Gigi's training, his education, his thorough musicianship. That was one of the things that that we heard, is that Monk said, that's a musician, because Gigi was able to play Monk's very difficult compositions. It was, you know, again, Gigi was not a street musician. He was really studied. He really had got his act together prior to even coming to New York. So Monk had a lot of respect for that, and Gigi was also able to work in collaboration with Monk to arrange some of the pieces for larger ensembles, which was one of the things that it was very successful about the Monk's Music album on Riverside, that you could have Ray Copeland and John Coltrane and G.G. Grice and Coleman Hawkins and this four-horn band playing these arrangements of Monk's music that really capture the, they don't sound overblown, they don't sound inconsistent with Monk's conception.
An excerpt from pianist Thelonious Monk's 1957 recording of his composition Epistrophe from the Riverside LP Monk's Music. We heard solos from tenor saxophonist John Coltrane, trumpeter Ray Copeland, and Gigi Grice on alto sax. We'll continue next week with Gigi Grice Part 2, Rat Race Blues, and learn why Grice, seemingly at the top of his profession, turned his back on the jazz world for the last 20 years of his life. Thanks for tuning into this edition of Nightlights. You can listen to this and other Nightlights programs and view playlists on our website at nightlights.indiana.edu. Support for Nightlights comes from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee and Juice Bar in Bloomington, Indiana. Nightlights is engineered by Michael Paskash and produced in the studios at WFIU at Indiana University. This is David Brent Johnson wishing you good listening for the week ahead.